All right, so one of the other things that I lost my train of thought. We talked about, I mentioned Begin, and really everything that had led to the creation of the state. So here we are now in week four. We've come a long way. We did a summary. We did just before the war. We did the war. And now we're talking about building a state in the 1950s. Right? All of a sudden, the dream has been realized. So we're going to talk about, of course, Israel right after the war, the challenge of creating an Israeli, right? And we'll get more into this when we talk about the Sephardi and the Mizrahi Jews that come in. But we're definitely going to mention that tonight. Defense is a priority. By the way, you know, I didn't put it in here, but defense is a priority. The economy is basically a one-and-a-half priority. The economy is a wreck, right? There's been destruction all over the country. The British have pulled out. There's no money. Things aren't going to improve, actually, until after 1952 when Ben-Gurion signs an accord with Germany for reparations, which was a very, very contentious matter. People like Begin were calling him a Nazi in the Knesset. So it's on record. Something called the Lavon Affair, which is a very complicated political mess that lasted for about 8 years. Building a relationship with France. Can anyone say nuclear weapons? The 1956 Suez War, which is often called the Sinai Campaign, or it's called Operation Susanna. And Moshe Dayan. Perhaps the most iconic, famous Israeli of the era, other than Ben-Gurion. And Dayan would really stay on the stage until his death in October 1981. So this, by the way, is a poster from 1950s, Israel Independence Day. And Yom HaAtzmaut, Israel Independence Day, and that's the year in Hebrew, and it says Yisrael. And, you know, this has a portion of the symbol for Israel, but what's neat about it is it combines the agriculture and the rose and the menorah, the Chanukiah.
That's supposed to be a rose?
I think it's a rose,
isn't it?
Looks
like a poppy.
Maybe it's a poppy.
But I wonder why that flower.
I think that flower is actually, I don't know what it's called in English, it's called a kalyanot. And they're red flowers that grow in the spring along all the fields in Israel. The nickname for the British soldiers also were kalyanot, because they were redbacks, mm-hmm. right? Like the Americans used mm-hmm. to call them. Now, why they called them that then, I don't know, because they didn't have red uniforms anymore. But I guess they were just still known as that. But the kalyanot.
London just,
mm-hmm. What?
London just had a whole ceremony for their veterans.
The poppy fields.
The poppy fields.
That was for World War I.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
For the veterans.
Was that for the World War I celebrations?
Yeah.
The 100th anniversary? Yeah.
Yeah, they've been adding poppies to around the Tower of London and spreading them out since August. And now they're like, they had one for each soldier from, I think, Britain and the Allies who died in World War I.
It's beautiful. Yeah, World War I is truly a forgotten war. For obvious reasons, we move away from time. But speaking of that, you know, it's always a huge debate. We put so much emphasis today on education about the Holocaust. I always like to challenge Jewish students when I'm dealing with them. You know, I start by saying, what do you remember about the expulsion from Spain? And they're like, what? And, you know, that's before I show them the clip from Mel Brooks' The Inquisition, which I do show in a Jewish humor lecture. But, you know, I say to them that it was equally horrible in its time. So are we going to remember the Holocaust in 100 years? And we go on from there. And, you know, is it enough what we've done and what have you? Let me get rid of that. All right, so Israel after the war. The first thing to think about is there was a huge sense of relief. Right? Remember, Yigal Alon comes in a couple days before the war to Ben-Gurion and says, 50-50% chance that we're going to survive. 50-50. Can you hold off on declaring independence? And Ben-Gurion says, no, this is the moment. This is it. Jewish history has been waiting for this. We're going to do it. They made it. There was a horrible cost. Literally 1% of the population was killed. That would be the equivalent of about 3.15 million Americans being killed in about a little less than a year. 3.15 million Americans being killed in a little less than a year. 1% of the population. The population of Israel during the time of the war is 650,000. Immigrants are starting to come in during the war, But many more come in after the war, obviously. In the early 50s in particular, we're going to see hundreds of thousands coming in, which in its own right puts a tremendous strain on the economy of the country. We mentioned before the economy was in ruins, and not only was the economy in ruins, but the soldiers were coming home, right? The government was no longer feeding, housing, and clothing the soldiers. Now, Israel has a socialized economy at this point, remnants of which remain today, and it's still not enough for these folks, because the most important thing they need is what? What do you think?
Jobs.
Jobs. Like we say here, jobs. Right? And jobs will be found in construction. You know, the joke is, by the way, that the national bird of Israel is the crane. Right? Because there are cranes whenever you, all of us. I remember very clearly the first time I went to Israel with my wife. It was my honeymoon. I met my brother-in-law. We were driving along the road. And I said, wow, Ophir, there's just like so much building going on. He goes, building, building, building. That's all we do in Israel. Build, build, build. He said, we don't care about anything else. We just build, build, build. There are new territories to rule, but the loss of the old city. This is a thorn in the side of all the military leaders in particular who feel they lost a golden opportunity. And we've seen pictures in the past of the Jews being evacuated from the old city during one of the truces because they thought they couldn't hold it. We saw a picture, I believe it was last week, of a Jordanian soldier standing in the ruins of the synagogue, the Horva synagogue.
Yeah.
We saw what happened to that. Everything Jewish in East Jerusalem was destroyed. Everything. The area between the Western Wall and the houses there, it's not the Mugrabi Gate area. I can't remember the name of the neighborhood. Just threw trash in it. It was just a dump. They didn't care.
They came right through the Vanderbilt Gate.
No, I mean the name of the there's a neighborhood right in front of there was an Arab neighborhood right in front of there, which was bulldozed after the 67 war.
Yes.
That, of course, violated the Armistice Accords, right? Freedom of religion. Jews were supposed to be able to go to the Western Wall, freedom of religion. Nobody really did anything about it. That was just one of the things the UN didn't care about.
Neil, was there a concern the Western Wall was going to be defaced during the time?
Not defaced in the way that we think of it today in terms of graffiti or stuff like that, but just mistreated. Like I said, just, you know, donkeys going up and down the path. It was a very narrow path then. It was probably from here to that wall. And it was a throughway. And there were houses all over here. When we get to that, I'm going to find some pictures for that to show you guys. It's kind of interesting, actually. It was an old, poor neighborhood right there. All right, but now there was a professional army. And particularly, we had the Palmach regulars were integrated into the army, and we had some people coming in from overseas who were professional soldiers as well. Mickey Marcus would have been one example of that, his life was tragically cut down. There was a belief that the negotiations with the Arabs would lead to peace. And in fact, negotiations were scheduled, and they didn't go anywhere at all. The Arabs weren't interested. Right? There was actually a good feeling at the toss on the island of Rhodos. Anybody ever been to the island of Rhodos in Greece? Rhodos.
Yeah.
Neat little synagogue there that you can go into by the old city. I was there once. Very, very interesting. That's where the ancient Colossus was supposed to have stood, one of the seven man-made wonders of the ancient world. The Jordanians in particular got along with the Israelis. You know, basically, the Egyptians really didn't. The Syrians really didn't. The Lebanese always did, like today, what the Syrians want. Negotiations went nowhere. The UN did periodically appoint negotiators, as it continues to do, to go to the region and look, try and create opportunities for peace and what have you. But didn't go anywhere. Now is the time to cement diplomatic standing, yeah?
Before you move on to
Africa,
was there any attempt by either the United Nations or the world or the Arab countries to say from that the area that was left over, 48, that was taken over by Jordan, should be Palestine?
No.
Was there any effort made to say this is going to be the a nascent Palestinian state. We'll get more about the rest later.
So what we see is in a few years, the United Nations appoints a committee to talk again about how to implement its Palestine declaration, partition. So that would get to that, but nothing serious was ever done. One of the big concerns of a lot of people, including the Catholic Church, was what to do with Jerusalem. And there was a lot of pressure coming in that regard. You know, the Pope doesn't have the standing in the diplomatic world today that he had then, but he still has a lot of power now. But then it was even more so. It was even more so. It's time to cement diplomatic standing. There's a paradox taking place here. The Soviet Union recognized Israel. That stunned everybody. The Soviet Union would yank recognition from Israel when people from Lehi sent some letter bombs and bombed a Soviet consulate, I can't remember exactly where, in Europe somewhere. So they would yank their recognition. But there was some question as to whether or not Israel, whose leaders were socialists, would go to the east or the west. Ben-Gurion made a strategic choice to go west. So he tried to cultivate relations with the United States, which still had an arms embargo. He even worked on cultivating relations with Great Britain, which until recently was the enemy. So much so that by 1956, as we're going to see, they're going to go to war with Great Britain and France against Egypt. It's only 7 years after independence. It's not that long at all. We begin opening trade with Africa. That really takes off in the 60s. Unfortunately, it's halted by the Six-Day War, but this is the beginning of that. Israel has always had a philosophy of the periphery. What we mean by that is, if I had a map here, if Israel was here and all the Arab states were here, we'd have the Persians, the Iranians over here. We can be friends with them. We have the Turks up here. We can be friends with them. We've got the Kurds in four countries here. We can be friends with them. And don't think Israeli agents aren't involved in what's happening to the Kurds right now. And then we have Africa down here. Now, what can we do with Africa? Why do we want ties with Africa? Thoughts?
They have resources.
They have resources, which we basically have none of.
And they have the market.
Population. The market. The population. Gaining friends. But a lot of it is we really can't sell our products to Europe the way we used to because the citrus trade isn't the big deal it once was in the 10s, 20s, and 30s, and 40s. Right? The Jaffa oranges. We all grew up on Jaffa oranges. You know, unfortunately,
a way of getting out of of what was basically a land blockade of Israel.
Right, but then after the Six-Day War, they're going to the Soviet bloc for a long time. I mean, Africa is filled with dictators, right? But you know, all these crazy stories, like we've seen the movies about Entebbe, who gave Idi Amin his paratrooper wings, right? The Israelis.
They
built the airport. They had the blueprints, you know, so. You know, fate. This comes in handy. You keep the blueprints.
They used to tell a story in the early 50s at the UN. The Arab the African countries couldn't talk to each other because they didn't speak the same language. The common language among the African delegates in the early 50s at the UN was Hebrew.
Hebrew. I was going to say French.
It was Hebrew because what the Israelis did is did a kind of a Peace Corps where they brought promising young Africans to Israel. They taught them agriculture, got them educated, taught them how to speak Hebrew, let them see the country, and then they went back and became the African leaders.
Excellent. And we still see some of that today, by the way. Remember the mall attacks about a year and a half ago in Kenya? Israeli security operation was in charge of that mall. Right? We still see Israelis throughout Africa in various areas. It's just very interesting. And it makes sense. They're nearby. Right, and some, but not many, of these countries, particularly as you go south, Rhodesia, Zimbabwe, Angola, have small Jewish communities. So there's a base there. Now, they're small Jewish communities because they're former British colonies, and they settled there because of that. I used to know a guy when I lived in Atlanta. His name was Andre Schnabel, and he was from Zimbabwe, and he was a sheep farmer. And in Atlanta and North Georgia, he bought a farm, and he continued to be a sheep farmer. You know, that's what they did in those types of places. All right. So, whoops, we disappear. That's what happens when I blabber. All right. One of the first things that they did diplomatically was they staked a claim to Jerusalem. Jerusalem was supposed to be an international city. They had captured half of Jerusalem. And remember, they had that little road that went up to Mount Scopus, where the Hebrew University is today. That was a Hebrew University campus then, but what it really turned into was an Israeli Defense Forces outpost. And disguised as supply trucks, they would send, you know, and people dressed not as soldiers, they would send stuff up there, you know, every week or two for a just supplies mission because people were living there. They said it was students using the library, researching, what have you. One of the first things they did, remember the armistice accords aren't signed yet. Some of them don't get signed till I think Egypt might have been the last one in April. January 23rd, 1949, the Knesset passes a resolution. Jerusalem is and has always been the capital of Israel. Doesn't define the borders. Doesn't say east or west. Says Jerusalem. This contravenes the UN partition plan, as does Hussein taking the West Bank. April 28, 1949, the Knesset moves from Tel Aviv to King George Street in Jerusalem. Anyone ever seen the building there? It's right by the Jewish Agency building. It's got a little plaque outside. I'm not sure what it's used for right now.
Why are you saying Hussein takes
the West Bank? Oh, yeah, why am I saying Hussein? That should be Abdallah. Sorry, my mistake. I need to correct that. I'm so used to saying Hussein for so many years. April 4th, the UN declares Jerusalem should be an international city. Pressure is mounting against Israel. This is its first diplomatic challenge. April 28th, Knesset moves. All right, I already had that. I repeated that. Well, that's a bad slide. I got to take care of that.
No,
it happened.
You just made the point.
What?
You made the point.
That's right.
More forcefully.
So, the UN is debating how to implement its partition plan. There you go. 1949. I'm going to read this because this is really the statement that drives Israeli policy until today. This is the old Knesset building. Here's Ben-Gurion down here. Jewish Jerusalem. Now, he's making a distinction. Isn't that interesting? Jewish Jerusalem is an organic, inseparable part of the State of Israel, just as it is an integral part of Jewish history and belief. Jerusalem is the heart of the State of Israel. We are proud of the fact that Jerusalem is also sacred to other religions and will gladly provide access to their holy places and enable them to worship as and where they please, cooperating with the UN to guarantee this. A nation that for 2,500 years has faithfully adhered to the vow made by the first exile by the waters of Babylon not to forget Jerusalem, Psalm 135. We looked at that in our first slide on the first day. You know, I mourn for thee, Jerusalem. Nobody pays attention to the end of that psalm. Cleave to my mouth and my right hand forget its cunning. Nobody remembers the last part of that psalm. It basically says, it directly says, and if it doesn't happen, I will dash my babies upon the rocks. So take a look, 135. Jewish Jerusalem will never accept alien rule after thousands of its youngsters liberated their historic homeland for the third time, redeeming Jerusalem from destruction and vandalism. Third time, 70 CE, 132 CE. Remember, Ben-Gurion and his group, they don't care about Talmud and Middle Ages and everything that made Judaism, the religion, what it is today. They are nationalists. Nationalism stopped for them in 135 with Bar Kokhba's defeat. And here's the little, as we say in French, the Utz. We do not judge the UN, which did nothing when nations which were members of the UN declared war on its resolution of 29 November 1947, trying to prevent the establishment of Israel by force, to annihilate the Jewish population in the Holy Land, and destroy Jerusalem, the holy city of the Jewish people. Interesting that Ben-Gurion talks about something being holy. He means it in an entirely different way. Had we not been able to withstand the aggressors who rebelled against the UN, Jewish Jerusalem would have been wiped off the face of the earth, the Jewish population would have been eradicated, and the state of Israel would not have arisen. Thus, we are no longer morally bound by the UN resolution of November 29, since the UN was unable to implement it. In our opinion, the decision of 29 November regarding Jerusalem is null and void. Talk all you want. We don't care. We won. And we won because if we had lost, we'd be dead. And it's hard to argue otherwise because, you know, there's a famous story. I think it might have been Moshe Dayan who taught it. We're going to talk about it later. Who, I think it was after the 67 war. They had captured some Arabs, and the Arab leader said, captain said, what are you going to do with us? And he said, we're not going to do anything to you that you wouldn't do to us. And he said, oh no, please don't do that. Seriously, that's an actual story. All right, so one of the things the state needed to do was to create everything. Everything! This is actually from the 60s. They needed money. They had the Palestinian pounds. Now, they could have kept it in circulation, but they weren't going to print anymore, right? And they did keep it in circulation for a while, but they weren't going to print anymore. We have the first Israeli stamps. Anybody remember? Everybody remembers Asimonim, right? Yeah. I'll tell you a very quick, unfunny story that happened to me. I get married with my wife in 1994. Going to Israel for our honeymoon. I'm going to meet her whole family there. She goes, oh, no, I don't have any Israeli money. How are we going to call them? I said, don't worry. I've saved these asimonim for my last trip. I have like 20 of them. I go and I find a phone. They only take phone cards. There's no longer asimonim in the country. So, you know, my bad Hebrew at that point, I flagged some guy down and borrowed what was one of the early cell phones, which was a flip phone. You know, I actually saw someone with a flip phone on Monday. I was like, how old is that phone?
I have one in my pocket.
There you go. How old is it?
It should live and be well. I don't know. I've had it for years.
That's right. It works. That's what counts.
That's right. It rings, honey.
People used to wear these around their neck as necklaces. They were on little like strings or something because that was the only way you could keep track of them. Israel was not the only country to use these telephone tokens. You know, then everything became a telephone card. Then, like here, they took away all the public phones, basically, and now everybody has a cell phone.
Or two.
Or two. Yeah, a lot of people have two. 1952 10-pound note. First Israeli stamps. Boy, I got to proof these slides. This is the official emblem of the State of Israel. The harvest, which goes back to biblical times. The menorah, which goes back to Judah Maccabee. And it's a copy of the menorah that's on the Arch of Titus in Rome. Why?
Because it came out of the temple.
Pillaging of the temple.
Exactly. So they're making a statement. Exactly. We're home. Exactly it. But you think about it, the challenge for the state was to create everything. And what they did between November and May was create every government bureaucracy you can think about. This is one thing that the Palestinian Arabs didn't do. Their leadership had fled. You know, if the Jews are anything, they're hyper-organized. And these people, the Jews, had been organizing themselves for years. Remember, the first Jewish defense organization came in 1910 with Hashomer, 39 years earlier. But they literally get committees together, they sit down, they say, what do we need? And they plan in 9 months a government, or 7 months, a government. Now, they had a foundation, but it was a pretty Herculean task. They needed everything. And remember, the British left them nothing. Nothing. The British literally took the typewriters away. You know, they're nothing whatsoever. The big challenge, and we'll talk about it more in the weeks to come, was creating an Israeli. There was a huge culture clash, which dissipates as time goes on, but still has echoes today, because hundreds of thousands of Jews, a million Jews, were coming from all over. A couple from the U.S., some from Poland, some from Afghanistan. I had a friend years ago in Israel. His mother was from Afghanistan. At one point, there were 5,000 Jews there. Because remember, Afghanistan is, you know, kind of fake borders, like most countries in the world. The United States is one of the few that doesn't have fake borders because we have oceans on both sides. So they could have very well been Jews in northern India or something like that. England, South Africa. What famous Jew was born and raised in South Africa? Aubrey Ibn, as we like to call him. Morocco, Yemen, Iran, Germany. I think there are Jews from 82 countries. I'd have to go back and check that number, but that's what I remember hearing in Israel. Now, the map has changed. If you were from Czechoslovakia, that's two countries now. So, who knows what it might be. The veterans, the people that had stayed in, that came to Israel in the 1910s, 20s, and 30s, were used to thwarting authority, right? How can we get around the British and what they're trying to impose upon us? We're hiding weapons, we're not paying taxes, we're smuggling people in. This becomes a problem for a new state. All the veterans, all they know, and this becomes a problem when the Soviets / Russians come too, what they know is how to try and beat the system. This is a big social issue. The newcomers are used to being pushed around, right? The sheikh, the king, the emir, the whatever, we were second-class citizens. We're not necessarily going to speak up against authority, but we're not going to do something unless you tell us what to do. Some would angrily lash out at authority eventually. Traditional family units were destroyed. What you would have happen is in the old country, in Yemen, my father, my grandfather, learned Talmud all day. Honorable person? Sure. Honorable person. Come to Israel, you're stuck in a what's called a ma'abara, or a transit camp. You got, you know, the labor guy comes and says, hey, Pop, we got to train you to harvest wheat. We got to train you to work a machine. You can't do this. This is the new Zion. And this guy's looking up, if he understands Hebrew, and saying, for this I came here. A lot of tensions. Fathers are no longer role models for their kids. Kids learn Hebrew right away. Kids learn other languages right away. Kids go to school, 5, 6, 7, 8 years old, go shopping with their father or their mother, have to translate. The parents are lower in the eyes of the kids because of this. Because the parents can't navigate the new culture. And it's a shock. Because it's, you know, not a culture that has a lot of support built in. Right? You come to this country, you're a Soviet Jew. What did we do for Soviet Jews? What did we do for them in the 70s, 80s, and 90s?
The U.S.?
Yeah.
Set them up.
We got them apartments. We gave them money. We gave them clothes. We helped them get a job. What?
Cars.
Some of them got cars. We gave them free memberships to the JCC. Right?
Hebrew free loan.
We did everything we could. By the way, I think in part psychologically, because we didn't do everything we could during the Holocaust. And I think that always lingered with us. That wasn't happening here. It was a lot harder. There were so many people. Extended family units are gone. Who grew up in a neighborhood where their aunts and uncles and cousins were down the street? Right? I still have cousins in Baltimore. I still have a cousin 2 blocks behind me. I don't talk to her, but that's another story. But I'm willing to. I've invited her over. That's gone. That world's gone.
Was this because of the kibbutz?
No. Some were eventually sent to kibbutzim, and particularly moshavs, but it didn't work that well, although there are still a number of Yemenite moshavs. I was for 7 months on a kibbutz called Chanita, where around where Moshe Dayan was stationed against the Vichy French when he lost his eye. And the kitchen was controlled by the Romanians, and the field was controlled by the Tunisians. So some went to kibbutzim, but it was very fresh. And this was in the 80s.
You're really talking about immigration of people from...
No, kibbutzim...
No, I mean, what you're talking about, this slide here.
Yeah.
It's talking about people from other countries coming to Israel.
Yeah, that's because they literally wholesale communities got up and left.
And we'll dig more. 250,000 Moroccan Jews, for example. You know,
a lot of people.
Didn't most of those people come, though, after the 67 war?
No, most of the Moroccans came before, actually.
Kicked out?
Actually, in Morocco, they actually, with King Hassan, they had a pretty good deal.
Yeah. Moroccans came in waves.
Yeah.
48, 67.
Well, there were some earlier in the early 50s. Yeah. Early 50s. Morocco actually is an odd situation. They were generally protected by King Hassan and King Hassan II. In fact, there's a statue to him in the old Jewish quarter in Rabat. But they felt that Zion was the place that they wanted to go. And Arya Derry, for example, came over as a kid from Morocco. I think that was actually in the early 60s.
They had lost their equal status as citizens.
In some of the countries. Well, some of the countries they didn't have equal status.
Yeah, but Morocco had it.
Right.
And Vichy France had taken it away. It wasn't going to be restored.
Particularly when the French were leaving Algeria, Tunisia, places like this. In countries in particular where Islamic law became part of, but not entirely, the law of the country, they were given what's called the al-Dimi status, which is second-class status. It's a legal classification of second-class citizenship. And it's really bizarre. You're allowed to oppress Jews, but not too much. Definition, you know, left to be open. Work was different. The ones coming from Poland or Germany, they weren't going to own a store that their father had owned. They didn't have license contracts. They couldn't be a plumber right away. They had to learn the language first. You know, if you go to, you know, one of the worst things that can happen in some regards is you go to Israel as a doctor. You don't speak English, you don't speak Hebrew. You know, there were examples of the past wave of Russian immigrants from, I guess, 87 to 2000, people sweeping streets with good licenses.
Neil, the same thing happened here. When the Russians came,
right.
The professional people, the medical language was a little different.
Absolutely.
They had to go back to school.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have to be licensed. You're absolutely correct. You have to be licensed. And, by the way, we want them to be licensed. You know, that's a good thing. And this is, they had no money saved up. They were thrust into a society where powers, MB were secular. Powers, I apologize for the typos tonight, where the powers that would be, that were secular. These were, if not religious Jews, traditional Jews, Masoretim. A traditional Jew, like my Yemenite brother-in-law in Israel, goes to the synagogue every Shabbat morning that his father helped build, and then he goes to the beach in the afternoon, where he does his shopping or he watches TV. But he has Friday night dinner, and he goes to synagogue. Right? None of that. Ben-Gurion wasn't lighting candles. By the way, a little interesting side note to history, Sonia Peres, Shimon Peres' wife, always lit Friday night candles and basically kept Shabbat. He didn't, but she always did. The military was where the younger ones integrated into the state. And that's still the case today for a lot of people. Still the case today for a lot of people, particularly if you're a young adult from the United States or France or whatever. There are a lot of programs now where you can go to Israel and serve in the army. And if you choose to stay and become a permanent citizen, that counts as your military service. You learn Hebrew there, you learn the culture there, you learn the ethos of the society, which separates you again from your family. Because your 45-year-old father isn't going into the army. And your 70-year-old grandfather certainly isn't going into the army. So that's the role of the army. So, again, we're going to dig more into this. But what you're getting the concept of, hopefully, is tremendous pressures on this society, on this new society. This wasn't a society adapting to something. This was a society that was trying to form itself while other things were going on. Hang on a sec.
We'll probably get into this, but one of the challenges or one of the characteristics of the society, when the Sephardim came in, they were discriminated against.
Right.
And the vision of the Israeli was not the vision of the Sephardic Jew, per se.
Right, because they were creating the new Jew. In fact, they were creating the Hebrew. They weren't creating the Jew. They were
there were also stories that supported kids were taken away from their family.
That's a legend in the Yemenite community, and we will get into that. That some in the Yemenite community still believe that upwards to several thousand kids were separated from their parents and raised on secular kibbutzim and what have you. Or some were experimented on medically and died in their unmarked graves. There are stories about that too. Alright, so this is just a little bit more on that. Look at the jump. End of 48, 35,000 Jews in 20 camps. End of 51, 220,000 in 125 camps. And this is what they look like. Not a fun thing to be in when it's 95 degrees and humid, or when it's 42 degrees and it's raining for 3 or 4 days in a row. And if you've ever seen the movie, has anyone here seen the movie Salah Shabbati? Anyone else? It's with Koppel, actually, and a guy, Arik Einstein, who goes on to become a famous singer in Israel. It shows when it rains, the mud. You know, these were meant to, hang on a second. These were meant to be non-permanent areas, which last, some of them lasted till the early 60s.
I love the election scenes.
Yeah. It's a funny movie. We're going to see a clip from it. We'll see a clip from it when we get to that. All right, so obviously, Ben-Gurion is a defense hawk, we've mentioned. Defense is the priority. Because if you don't have defense, it all goes away. Yeah.
Can I just ask one question? Yeah. But there was still a push. Israel wanted as many Jewish people to come to the country.
Oh, even totally.
With the tension, I mean, they wanted them to be there.
Totally. Because what they were going to do was take the Jews and create a new Jew with them. In fact, they had something, they had a Hebrew phrase called negation of the diaspora. They believed, and this is interesting for us, I think we did mention it last year, that eventually the diaspora would disappear, and because of that, all the Jews need to come to Israel now. Now, statistically, that's accurate today, right? The diaspora is declining in number, particularly if you take out the Haredim, or the Black Hat Jews, dramatically were declining in some countries. In fact, some countries, there are basically no more Jews, right? And you take a country like, people ask me what the future of the United States is going to be like. It's going to be like England. 1950, they had 350,000 Jews. Today, they have about 250,000 Jews. You know? Now, it's a whole issue in terms of how you count who's a Jew. Right? Surveys tell us there are between 5.2 to 6.7 million Jews in this country. That's 1.5 million people. Difference. That's a lot of people. So, it's complicated. Here are some examples of some things that were happening. And Israel claims there were 9,000 attacks on it. Now, some of these attacks, literally, were people crossing the border to harvest their fields, you know, that first year in particular. Some of them were bandits coming to rob someone. And some of them are what were called fedayin. We'll get to that in a little bit, which are basically terrorists. You know, fedayin, they cross the border with guns, and they want to hurt somebody. The Arabs, particularly Egypt, encouraged this. That was part of their foreign policy. Their foreign policy was to make life miserable for the Israelis. So here's the fedayin, Arabic for one who risks his life voluntarily. It's the cross-border operations. The first one, trying to date, it was in 51. Came from Jordan and Gaza after that. According to the Jewish Agency, this number seems high to me. That's why I sourced it. There were 400 Israelis killed. Could be. I just don't know of enough larger incidents. And I track it. Actually, there's a thing online that tells you what happened every single year, every single month and year in Israel. I don't see where they get it from, but they source it. Interestingly enough, the Israeli Arabs are not a factor, as they are literally today, when there's some rioting going on. The Israeli Arabs aren't a factor for a couple reasons. Anybody have any thoughts as to why? Why aren't the Israeli Arabs participating in this violence against the Jews?
They were happy with the employment, and in fact, them.
To an extent, they had a life of stability, to an extent.
They didn't want to get thrown out.
They were under military curfew until 1966. You want me to say it again?
They didn't want to get thrown out.
They didn't want to get thrown out, and they were in shock. And most of them were in their villages, and they wanted to be left alone. They didn't really have much to do with the Jews. They had their own subsistence economy, agrarian. Some were in mixed cities. There's still some Arabs in Haifa. There's still some Arabs in Jaffa. Very few in Tiberias. There's certainly plenty of Arab villages in the Galilee, particularly in the area they call the Triangle. All right, so that's the Fedayeen. And the Fedayeen is a phrase that continues to exist today. It's kind of might be what we call a freedom fighter. In response to this, a man named Ariel Sharon bursts onto the scene. Very, very complicated guy. By the way, I told you guys a few weeks ago I was reading David Landau's biography of Sharon, and I didn't think it was that good. It's gotten a lot better. So I can recommend it now. Start out very slowly. Ariel Sharon, we remember, was wounded in the Battle of Latrun in 47 and 48, the various battles there. He was shot in the stomach. He was dragged to safety. Ben-Gurion loved the guy. He thought he was the daring new young Israeli. This was the prototype of what he wanted. And there's many conversations recorded of other officers coming to Ben-Gurion and saying, Sharon lies, he gets out of control, we can't trust him. And Ben-Gurion says, you know, leave him be, I'll talk to him. And he brings him in and he says, Arik, you know, you really can't lie as much anymore, you have to tell the truth. And Sharon says, okay, I will. And, you know, it's this mentor relationship. But they turn to Sharon to form Unit... I'm sorry, first they form Unit 30, which is a secret unit. It's a lousy unit because all the officers from Palmach have resigned. Because the Palmach officers resigned because they didn't like the fact that Palmach wasn't going to be a separate unit anymore. So it's disbanded the next year, and they call in Sharon in Unit 101. Unit 101, 25 men, you have to be voted into the group by others. So if someone's killed or leaves, you have to be voted in. They take them exclusively from the kibbutz and moshav because only the farmers will really appreciate the land. What they do is they engage in military reprisal operations for every single Arab attack. So basically almost every night, they were out on a mission. And their goal was to make the Arabs pay for inflicting damage to Jews and Jewish communities. It only answered to the general staff, which meant the other officers didn't like it. It was both successful and controversial. By late 95, after what we see next, it was called the Kibia Massacre. It's disbanded because what they say is, you know, Ark, you've done a great job. You know, forget the fact that we have international condemnation and a lot of people hate your guts for what you're doing now. We need you to instill Unit 101's values into the overall army. It's what we call being bumped up. All right. The most controversial thing they did was called the Kibia Raid. Anyone ever heard of it? Okay. It was one of many raids, as I said. The northern West Bank town. This, by the way, is a Palestinian serving Kibia after the Unit 101 got through with it. There were some border raids from Jordan. A few people were killed. It was said that the attackers originated from Kibia. The Jordanian Legion was stationed there. And remember, King Abdallah didn't want the Jordanian Legion to go to war with Israel, but there was a matter of Arab pride. So he was not going to turn his back on the cause. They mined the homes. Criticism is they didn't closely inspect them. 70 villagers killed. 2/3 were women and children. UN observers come in and look at the area. It's not dissimilar than what happens today. There's an international outcry. The United States suspends aid to Israel. We've started seeing a little bit of aid to Israel at this point. Making matters worse is Israel denies responsibility for the action. Now, very often, Israel's learned its lesson since then. What Israel does is it just doesn't comment. You know, it blows up a Syrian nuclear bomb site, and They just say, we have no comment on it. They learn their lesson over the years. This infuriated people. Unit 101 was disbanded. And there, you know, Moshe Dayan wants it to go to the overall army. He'd also like to have control of it. You know, full control of its officers. Then, let's see how we're doing time. We're doing fine. Something called the Levone Affair. This is the most complicated political mess in Israel's history. Does anybody know anything about it? We know.
There was a commando raid into Egypt, I guess.
Kind of close. It was Egypt.
Yeah, Egypt. And basically, it was a communications... It didn't work. It
right.
was a disaster. And there was a communications breakdown
mm-hmm.
and as to whether Levone, who was, I guess he was defense minister
he
at
was
that time,
yeah.
without having a military background,
right.
whether he approved it or not, and whether or not he's told somebody to do this. And it's the same as Ben-Gurion discussing moving the Arabs from Lydda.
Right.
Yeah, you know.
They sent certain branch of the military, and it's not clear exactly authorized it, but they sent
right.
agents in to engage in subversive activities against Americans, hoping that it would create animosity between America and Egypt and create greater sympathy for Israel. And then it all got disowned, and then later Ben-Gurion, because of his own rivalries, wanted to have a transparent investigation
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And make sure blame was placed. And ultimately, and there was some guy, not Levone, but somebody else who apparently was really in charge, who was
Ghibli.
Really corrupt and
yeah.
ended up going to prison.
It's you all got bits and pieces of it.
The more I read, the muddier it got.
Right.
Egyptian Jews, and it
yes.
was very, very poorly organized. And they had these underpowered bombs.
Yeah, they had them in their pockets.
And one actually blew up one of the Egyptian Jews.
Right.
Which is actually how they upended and found the whole program. And then there was a lot of finger pointing. And the idea was to blow up American, British, and
right.
Even French. And just to show the British in particular, that the British would show the world they have to come back in. And police the situation because the Egyptians couldn't handle it.
Well, remember, the British were still in the canal zone and they were talking about leaving.
Right, so this would allow them to stay, and the Muslim Brotherhood were framed to be the perpetrators, but obviously they
didn't. So,
but they were caught. Some were caught.
Some were caught.
Some were hanged. Some were
two committed suicide.
And then some were in prison and eventually went, I'm not sure if it was prison or something, but eventually went back to Israel, but they had to keep quiet about that.
So you all pretty much have the bits and pieces.
Yes,
yeah. It's worse than Bay of Pigs because it lasts from 1954 really until 62. It keeps coming back.
It's on that order because it's a gift that keeps coming.
So you all pretty much got it. I want to try and quickly put the chronology in order. So in the Levone Affair, what we now believe happened is that the head of the Israel Military Intelligence, whose name is Gilby, and the name of that agency is called Aman, A-M-A-N, sent some people to Egypt to cultivate Egyptian Jews, including one who had worked with the Haganah to smuggle Egyptian Jews into Palestine and then helped them bring them to Israel, to say, look, we need you to recruit a couple of other Egyptian Jews, and what we need to do is bomb cultural centers, libraries, and places like that that the Americans and the Brits in particular own. We want you to put the bombs in there at night. We don't really want anybody hurt. We want to send a message to scare them to bring their focus back to Egypt so that the Brits don't pull out, which was being debated in the House of Commons at that time. So what we want you to do is to break into these places and put these nitroglycerin bombs in bookcases and file cabinets and whatever. We believe that Gilby could have been a double agent and he could have tipped off someone in Egypt. So what they did is they caught an Egyptian Jew who was walking to one of these centers, who had a bomb in his pocket that went off prematurely. Now, none of these people were seriously hurt. They weren't really powerful bombs. What happened is Israel denied all responsibility for this, of course. And Moshe Sharet, the prime minister, said to Pinchas Lavon, the defense minister, how could you authorize this? He said, I didn't authorize this. They had a commission of inquiry. They brought in Gilby and others who contradicted Sharet. Sharet leaves power. It festers. It festers because Pinchas Lavon has a lot of support in the party. And by 1960, when Ben-Gurion's finally back in power, Ben-Gurion agrees to have another commission look into this because some new information has come to light, and they basically point the finger at Gilby, and they say that Sharet is innocent. Ben-Gurion at one point resigns as defense minister because of this. He goes back to his kibbutz for a year and a half. Then he comes back as prime minister. He comes back as defense minister, and so on and so on. Let's see if I got it all. Oh, yeah, military censorship. You weren't allowed to talk about it in the media. They reported on the bad business in Egypt. I mean, you can't imagine a newspaper doing that today. The bad business in Egypt. It's like a bad business deal. Obviously, there's Golda Meir. Why was it such a big deal? And here's just kind of more information on that. Oh, yeah, Lavon also blamed Shimon Peres. Because everybody hated Shimon Peres. Because Shimon Peres never served in the military. He served in the youth group that did some military work, but he never served in the out-and-out military. And Peres was Ben-Gurion's guy, so that was a way of getting at Ben-Gurion. And he was also director general of the defense ministry. People might hate Peres for everything he did in some regard, but you got to give him tremendous credit. If it weren't for him, there wouldn't be weapons in Israel, particularly in the 1950s, and then, of course, the nuclear stuff. So it's a really complicated affair that kept coming back. David?
Pinchas Lavon was a cousin of a former sister-in-law of mine.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. And he said all along it was politically motivated.
And it was.
Yeah, and that's why they never... That's why it kept festering, because as different politicians got involved, then they had to, make their own bones, with respect to... We're good and he's bad. You trust this one, but don't trust that one.
Right.
And it just dragged on and on.
Did you ever meet him?
No, my brother did that.
Yeah? Yeah. You remember what he said about the conversation, or?
Not a whole lot to say. It was political.
Okay. Okay. That's kind of neat.
And the reason it dragged on is because every politician wanted to get his or her licks in. Well, his.
Right.
In those days, his licks in.
And it was a proxy fight against Ben-Gurion, too. There was the ruling party. It wasn't called the Labor Party then. It was Mapai, which stands for Miflegat Po'alei Yisrael, the Workers' Party of Israel. So the Workers' Party of Israel had a lot of factions. It was the ruling party. One of the elections, it had won 56 seats. Right? Didn't win an outright majority, but no one's ever come close to that, basically. Well, they got 49 in another election. So they're the only ones that would come close to it. So there were factions within there, and they all wanted to get at the old man because they all wanted to rule. So it was really like different parties within the party because they didn't care about the other parties. So that festered for years. And that would stay the way until 77 when Begin and the Likud would upend Mapai, or now Labor, rule. So with that, are there any questions before we take a break? Then let's take a break. Yeah, I can understand that. Who has anything else to do? Come on, get serious. Alrighty. So, we've been talking about Israel in the 1950s, and we just talked about the Lavon affair, and we talked about the challenges of building the society, and we've talked a lot about the defense needs of the country. Now we're going to spend a few minutes on the economy, because obviously after defense, the economy is going to be a top priority, and in fact, it might be equal. One of the things a lot of people don't know is that things in Israel economically were so bad that they literally had something called the policy of austerity, which lasted for about a decade. Everything was being rationed. It was like it was the end of the Soviet Union. Israel obviously has no natural resources other than sand. I've always wondered why they haven't been a great glass-producing country, but they're not. There are phosphates at the Dead Sea, which at this point holds promise, but still you're not going to run your whole economy on that. And if you think about it, you know, the only thing Israel has going for it then and now is ingenuity, is brains. I should say in terms of natural resources.
Could have tourism.
Tourism is very fickle. Tourism is a very fickle enterprise. At one point through the 1980s, tourism was the number one industry. Now it is high tech, by far. Tourism will never reach the level that high tech reaches now. Although that's a lucrative market. The big change in tourism, by the way, is internal Israeli tourism. The big hotels at the Dead Sea, they're filled with the Israelis. You know, I've been there a few times. They're all Russian-speaking Israelis. Eilat is actually a European port of interest as well. They had favoritism in the British markets until May 15th, 1948. They were part of the United Kingdom, right? So they didn't have to pay certain taxes. They were welcome in certain places with ease. We mentioned earlier, citrus was just no longer the big deal it once was. Citrus used to be a really big deal. Outside of Tel Aviv, particularly between Tel Aviv and Jaffa, because there was a between Tel Aviv and Jaffa then, were just rows and rows of citrus trees. I mean, I remember some of them in the early 80s when I first started going to Israel. But, you know, even by now, that's all gone. That was just a remnant. They had to feed the immigrants with no jobs. And by the way, these immigrants are used to, we didn't talk about this, but they're used to eating certain things. Their foods are gone. There's a shortage of foreign reserves to buy goods. Israel doesn't have money in foreign banks. You need money in foreign banks to conduct business. Israel doesn't have any money. So how can it have any money in foreign banks? In 1951, many foreign banks basically said, you're not worth the risk. You are not worth the risk. We're going to stop financing you. You know, your bond rating is going to be triple D or something like that. So here's a good example of Tel Aviv residents waiting to buy food ration stamps. You had to wait in line to buy the stamps to use for the food, which was ridiculous, right? They should just, you know, give you the food when you go in line. But it was a very serious situation there. And, you know, many of us remember, and they still have them today, actually, things like milk in little bags, and things used to be in unmarked tins in certain areas. There was nothing fancy about living in Israel at that point. They even created, in 1951, a ministry of rationing and supply, right? Bureaucracy of bureaucracies. At first, it was only oil, sugar, and margarine. They still have subsidies on certain things. Right? There was almost a riot a few years ago in the country when they were going to take the subsidy off yogurt. Or, no, it was cottage cheese. You know, when they were taking the subsidy off cottage cheese. So they still have subsidies on cottage cheese, I think milk, but I'm not sure anymore, and eggs. But they were the big things. People were told 1,600 calories a day. All right, so you go to a good meal in a restaurant, 1,600 calories, particularly if you eat dessert. You can't heat water from 10 to 6. Right, takes up too much energy. We got to wait till it cools off. So this is where Israeli ingenuity comes in. Engineer builds a solar water heater in the early 50s. Pretty cool thing. By 67, there's one in every 20 households. He becomes a millionaire in Israel. And one of the really great things about Israel for years, for decades, has been solar energy. It's really a wonderful, wonderful thing. And the country uses it. Black market soars. There's a black market. If you have some money, you can buy some things. Not unusual. We saw this again in Israel in the mid-80s when inflation was at 444%. We saw a black market. You would sell your money for one price one day because it would be worth more the next day, or less, depending on how you counted it. So in September 1950, the government even created the Office for Fighting the Black Market. Right, there's probably an office to watch the office or something like that. But it was a very serious situation. So think about it. It's 1951. You're rationing. You're fighting a black market. You're worried about your borders. You're absorbing hundreds of thousands of immigrants. You can't sell your goods anywhere. Great future for this country, huh? Things are tough. Things are very, very tough. It's amazing how far Israel has come. Amazing. One of the things they did do in this time was they built a relationship with France. This was critical for Israel. Shimon Peres was the guy in charge of this. In fact, the criticism of Peres from the 50s is that he spends more time in Paris speaking French than he does in Tel Aviv or Jerusalem speaking Hebrew. And he becomes a real international man at this point. So, France agrees to sell weapons to Israel openly. That's the difference, right? We've gotten some weapons from Czechoslovakia. We've gotten surplus weapons from the United States. Nothing is open until this point. So a guy named Guy Mollet becomes prime minister in 56. He is a socialist, and he is impressed with socialists. This will set the stage for Operation Susanna or the Sinai campaign. Israel starts getting weapons. Diane and Peres negotiate for more weapons. Israel is ecstatic because it means that it has a partner in Europe. It's got a foothold in Europe. Where is Israel getting the money from? We're going to talk more about it when we get to the Holocaust in Israel, but the reparations money. When the reparations money comes in the early to mid-50s, it changes everything almost overnight. And in fact, I told you my first trip to Israel in 1983, I remember saying to somebody, how come all the taxi cabs are Mercedes? That's so weird. And I said, well, it's for reparations, you know, because the reparations were paid out over 20 or 25 years, something like that. But a lot of taxi cabs were Mercedes-Benzes. Israel has tanks. Israel has Mystere jets. And Israel gets Sherman tanks from France, which they bought it from the United States. Well, go away. Where's Waldo? Oh, well. And half-tracks. So Israel is getting the proper armament. And all along, it continues to train soldiers and continues to absorb them. There's a compulsory draft now. In 1950, by the way, Ben-Gurion has signed an agreement with the ultra-Orthodox rabbis saying, don't worry, your 500 yeshiva guys don't need to serve in the army. How many yeshiva guys are there today?
50,000.
Something like that. I don't even know. It's certainly 500 is one yeshiva. Right? But then, because, and you know why Ben-Gurion did that back then? Because he said, these guys are going to disappear. Yeah. They're going to disappear. We don't worry about them. They're going to be absorbed into Israel. The Hebrews. So Israel is moving diplomatically. And that's when it moves on the ultimate weapon known as Israel's worst kept secret. I like to say I spent the longest month of my life one weekend with David's son in Dimona when he was living there working for the Jewish Agency for Israel. And all that.
Two people who spoke English.
And we played basketball with the black Hebrews on Shabbat afternoon. It was a good time. I just remember at night the sand blowing against the window, you know, from the windstorm that was sweeping across the desert. Dimona's a lousy place. Dimona and Yerocham are known as the armpits of Israel. Anyway, this is a nuclear reactor at Dimona. Now, my mentor, Dr. Robert O. Friedman, Bob Friedman, tells a great story of when he was in Israel in the early 60s and there was a bus and he was going by Dimona and all of a sudden it sped up so nobody could take a picture.
I have to get that picture.
I stole it from somewhere. Yeah.
Art Abramson spoke together last night and he said during the late 50s and early 60s what happened is the Israelis who had a no-fly zone suddenly, you know, rescinded that. So that when American satellites would fly over, they could see what the Israelis had. Never said anything. They just sort of rescinded the no-fly zone for maybe 6 months or a year.
Mm-hmm.
So that the Americans would know, without ever being told, that the Israelis had the nuclear capability. So when they started having problems with other countries in the Middle East in terms of problems like that, the Americans would go to the other countries and say, you really don't want to mess around with that. You know, or that they would, when other countries talked about getting nuclear, the Americans would gently go to them and say, you know, we don't think that's a really good idea. But it was interesting how they did it. They just opened up, they just opened up so that the satellites flying over could take pictures, and that was the end of it.
And I'm going to tell you an interesting side story about that in a few moments. But and to follow up on what David was saying, it's important to note, as you all know, that Israel has never admitted that it has nuclear weapons. It's called a policy of nuclear ambiguity. And the, you know, the reasons are obvious, but what Israel says whenever they're pressed is, we will not be the first ones to introduce nuclear weapons into the Middle East.
They've also never signed the non-nuclear proliferation.
And that becomes an issue. Israel not signing the nuclear proliferation, non-nuclear proliferation treaty, because Arab states say, we're not going to sign it if they don't sign it. And so on. So Egypt, we think, is doing research for a bomb. Saudi Arabia, for certain, is doing it because they have so much money that there's nothing standing in their way other than some U.S. pressure. And we know Syria just tried to do it, but Israel bombed their research facility. There's about 5 years ago, there's a debate as to whether or not they were close to being able to enact that facility. We know what Israel did in 1981 in Osirak, Iraq. I was actually sitting in your backyard around the pool watching at that point. Anyway, so, and we're going to talk, let me give you a little more on this. Let me go to the next slide. Come on. The road to nuclear power. 49, a few Israeli scientists are invited to stop by a French nuclear facility. Now, you know, scientists share things all the time with each other. They saw some nuclear tests. They were allowed to see some data from the tests, which is a really good thing. 52, Ben-Gurion decides to go nuclear. He says, this is our great insurance card. If we have a nuclear weapon, everybody will leave us alone. Or, if we go down, they're going down with us. And indeed, of course, we know in the first days of the 1973 Yom Kippur War, there was talk about using nuclear weapons. And, you know, Moshe Dayan was so shaken, apparently, that he said, I fear that the Third Temple is about to be lost. Third Temple is an analogy to the State of Israel. Avner Cohen has written, without the Holocaust, we cannot understand either the depth of Ben-Gurion's commitment to acquire nuclear weapons or his inhibitions about nuclear weapon policy. Anxieties became national policy. Now, I think he goes a little too far. Israel did have real threats facing it, and it was seen for many, many decades as the ultimate survival policy. And keep in mind, that was all before the Israeli Arabs became problematic in terms of security for the country. So he's just talking about foreign countries, other countries. So they signed a secret agreement. This agreement, by the way, signed September 17, 1956, is at a place called Sèvres, which is a small French town, where they also negotiated the final who's going to do what of the war that they were about to have against Egypt. So they had a side conversation. They literally stepped to a side room, and they decided that. So this guy, Maurice, I don't read French well, Bourget Manoré, does anybody read French?
Bourget Manoré.
Okay. Manoré, he said, he was only in power for that year, and he was a socialist too. But he said, I give you the bomb to prevent another Holocaust from befalling the Jewish people, and so that Israel could face its enemies in the Middle East. Israel, of course, was not beyond using the Holocaust to create sympathy for it. And the destruction of the Holocaust was real. It wasn't something that they made up. So there was both political opportunity and understandable anxiety and fear when 8 years earlier you learned that 6 million of your people were slaughtered. So we can imagine if the Kurds had a nuclear weapon, what the situation might be like today. You know, I pointed out to you before, There are 40 million Kurds in the world, right? There are 15 million Jews. 40 million Kurds. So they've signed the agreement, finally, the last one on October 3rd, 57, to build a 24-megawatt reactor. But the one they actually built would wind up being 2.5 times as large. Now, when word got out to people like the Americans and others, they said, oh yeah, we're building a reactor. It's only for experimental purposes. And there was a section of it that was cordoned off where they would show foreign guests. But there was kind of like, you know, the old movies where you take a book off the bookcase and the wall opens and you go in. And there's a great book about this. It's called The Bomb in the Basement by a guy named Michael Karpin, who's an Israeli journalist. He does phenomenal research on this stuff. They were also building another small reactor on the shore. It was up by Ashdod and Ashkelon around there. And that was purely for research, and they would take people to that as well. All right. So, the bomb building part was secret, but it wasn't a diplomatic secret. Because Eisenhower in 58 was shown aerial photos, as David was just talking about. Eisenhower was upset. Eisenhower was upset, and now Eisenhower and Israel didn't have a good relationship, and Ben Gurion. In fact, Eisenhower forced them to withdraw from the Sinai in what would be early 57. They went, in late 56, they took it. Eisenhower was the one who forced them out. So in response to American pressure, Ben-Gurion says in the Knesset, we are present, he walks up, Ben-Gurion would do this. He would come in, he would walk up to the podium, he would say something, and he would leave. Just like he's going to do in 1961 when he basically says, today, our agents in Argentina captured Adolf Eichmann. See ya. You know, just like that. We are presently engaged in building a research reactor with 24,000 thermal kilowatt output to serve the purposes of industry, agriculture, medicine, and science. Israel's only official statement ever on their nuclear reactor. So when it came to Israel, he also said it was going to desalinate water. Mordechai Vanunu, some of us know that name, in 86, he takes pictures, he sells them to some British newspapers, he says Israel has more than 100 nuclear warheads, and we talked about the policy of purposeful ambiguity. Very, very important. Israel has, it's amazing, you think about it, by 1986, Israel has 100 nuclear warheads. This is a state that, you know all the challenges we've been talking about. This is unbelievable. And Ben-Gurion found money for this. He kept finding money for this. He would steal from that budget and that budget and that budget. This was his pet project. Now, this was a serious, serious thing to Ben-Gurion. And for him, this was his legacy. Right? Nobody's going to screw with you when you get the nuclear bomb. So he thought. Meanwhile, tensions are mounting with Egypt. We've already had the Levant affair, which ratcheted up the tensions. It's 9 years after, or 7 years after a humiliating loss to the state of Israel. Nasser is in power. Nasser is a nationalist looking to sow his oats. Egypt has closed the Suez Canal immediately after the war, contravening the UN armistice agreement. Now, Egypt closes the Straits of Tiran. The Straits of Tiran, if we had the map, the canal would be up here. The Straits of Tiran goes up here. This is Eilat. If you can't go through here to the Mediterranean, and you can't get up here to Eilat, you can't bring anything in from this whole part of the world on a boat. And shipping's very important. It's the cheapest way to bring goods in. So, Israel begins conspiring with Britain and France. Fedayeen attacks are stepping up. Nasser, on October 25th, takes command of the Syrian and Jordanian armies. All right, he says to them, this is it. We're going to get rid of this incredible stain. Anybody know what the Arabs call the 48 war? The Nakba, which means the tragedy, catastrophe, disaster. We're going to get rid of the Nakba. Ala Ibn, the forever ambassador to the United States, the United Nations, and at the same time, ambassador to the United States of America. I saw him, by the way, speak in Atlanta on, it was then his 80th birthday. You know, they wheeled out a cake for him, I think it was 1995, and I'll never forget something he said, when he said, "I am a lonely member of the founding generation of the State of Israel."
He was the last.
Unless you want to count Paris.
Yeah.
Who, you know, he's 90 years old, God bless him, 91.
Right.
I mean, I saw Avi even as an elderly man trying to get a cab in front of the King David Hotel. They wouldn't pick him up.
Oh, that's horrible. That's horrible. I mean, the most eloquent spokesperson in the world. All the other Israelis looked at him as being naive. They looked at him as not being a heavyweight, not being an intellectual, and yet, you know, incredibly articulate, totally committed to the concept of the Jewish state and Jewish history. If you look at his History of the Jewish People stuff, you know, really nice stuff. Really nice stuff. Some of you have seen the documentaries he's made. Really good stuff. Israel mobilizes 100,000 troops in 24 hours. So keep in mind, the economy has stopped once again. On October 29, 56, Israeli troops invade the Sinai. The plan is, some of you mentioned earlier, Israel's going to invade the Sinai. Britain and France are going to say, it needs to be a ceasefire. Everybody freeze where you're at. Egypt's going to reject that. Britain and France are going to say, we're bringing in our troops to protect the canal zone. Israel goes faster than anticipated. I mean, they conquered the whole thing in 100 hours. 100 hours. So the Brits and the French finally get some troops there, and then the Egyptians, of course, rejected the ceasefire, and they were pummeled once again. So the next day, Abba Ibn says, during the 6 years during which this belligerency has operated in violation of the armistice agreement, there have occurred 1843 cases of armed robbery and theft, 1330 cases of armed clashes with the Egyptian armed forces, another typo, 435 cases of incursion from Egyptian-controlled territory, 170 cases of sabotage perpetuated by Egyptian military units in Fedayeen in Israel. As a result of these actions of Egyptian hostility within Israel, he says 364 Israelis were wounded. Man, who did this? And 101 were killed. So he's making the international case. As I said, the plan goes well. Israeli troops sweep in from three areas. There goes, according to the script, the Brits finally take Port Said up there. But the Soviets threaten every kind of modern destruction weapon if there's no ceasefire. What are they saying they're going to do? Use a nuke. That's what they're saying. They're going to use a nuke. Because this was something you said back then. Nonetheless, after it was all over, it ushers in 11 years of relative peace, which is the longest period of time that Israel has ever gone without a war, if you count the intifadas, which I would count the intifadas. And unfortunately, we've seen three wars in the last 5 years, if you want to count the Gaza uprisings or disturbances. Israel captures a huge amount of territory. Huge amount of territory. And they're going to be right back there 11 years later. Eisenhower forces an Israeli withdrawal. He's upset that he wasn't informed. He thought he had a good relationship with Ben-Gurion. David, why didn't you tell me? What's going on here? So he joins the Soviets in pressuring Israel. They threaten to expel Israel from the United Nations. If Israel is expelled from the United Nations, it no longer has the permission of the nations to exist. Now, Israel might just say, who cares? But that could have all types of trade implications and what have you. The U.S. promises if you do withdraw, we will maintain freedom of navigation of the seas. This is something that's going to come back in 67 in May when President Johnson tries to put together an international flotilla to open the Suez Canal to Israeli shipping. in the streets of Tehran. It's not going to work. March 57, Israeli troops withdraw. Something called the UN Emergency Force is created, and it sticks around until Nasser kicks it out in 1967, one of the great tragedies of the modern Middle East. Many people now believe that when Nasser said to the United Nations, "You need to leave," he didn't expect them to leave. And he wouldn't have attacked Israel, or he wouldn't have gone to prepare for war against Israel had there been UN troops there. Nobody can prove or disprove that, but that's what some people now believe. Another one is created until 73. Another one is created in 73, and it stays in existence till 79, when we have the Israeli-Egyptian peace treaty starting to go into force. Remember, the Israeli-Egyptian peace treaty had a phased withdrawal from the Sinai Desert. So let's see. I think we have enough time. Let's watch a quick thing on the war. Let's see. I have it over here, right? I love this. The South African Zionist Federation.
On October the 29th, 1956, Israel mobilized. Within hours, the army stood ready, and all the effective reserves, every able-bodied man and woman in Israel, stood with them. For 8 years, raids by Fidayin, the Egyptian suicide commandos, had broken all international agreements. Over 1,000 Israelis had been killed, many of them civilians. Countless cattle had been stolen. Water pipelines had been destroyed. In Cairo, Colonel Nasser had threatened to completely annihilate Israel, and even now was planning an invasion. Israel was forced to strike back, and so on this day, mechanized units and infantry moved across the border into the Sinai Desert to attack. Protests and minor reprisals had failed to halt Nasser's Fidayin outrages. With reluctance, Israel resorted to all-out assault. With infantry in close support, the offensive got underway, rolling back the numerically superior Egyptian opposition. Operating from such outposts, the Fidayin had been bold enough in staging surprise raids on civilians, but fled in disorder when faced with military opposition. The Israel Defense Forces swept on, meeting token opposition except in related cases. Gathering impetus, the advance left stranded Egyptian vehicles in its wake. 2 months before, Nasser had formed an alliance with Jordan and Syria against Israel. But every mile overrun was reducing the dictator's grandiose schemes of conquest to ashes, death, and disillusionment. This was the result of rabble-rousing and invoking mass hysteria. Vital roads sent to Israeli hands, allowing the freer movement of troops and supplies. False reports given to the world by Cairo spoke of the invaders being annihilated. Far from being annihilated, the Israeli forces dug in occasionally, preparing against the counterattacks which never came. Human endurance demanded rest. Women with the forces scanned the wilderness of sand, which two full Egyptian divisions were supposed to be defending. The advance had carried the army well into the Sinai Desert and within a few miles of the Suez Canal. Fluid in more senses than one, the situation offered little respite for collecting accurate information, making reports, and attending to even the smallest personal matters. Up forward, the spearhead of the attack was flushing out pockets of resistance and causing heavy losses in lives and equipment. Practically all Egypt's equipment, many million pounds of which was captured and destroyed, had been supplied by countries behind the Iron Curtain. Subsequently, great stores and dumps were found untouched. True, much of it was intended for the invasion of Israel, but it's more likely that it had been dumped in readiness for the alleged volunteers from Iron Curtain countries who might be sent in later. Troops can be flown in quite easily and immediately become a formidable force if their heavy armor is already on the spot awaiting them. We cannot as yet fully comprehend the motives behind the supply of this war material, nor can we accurately assess Russia's interest in Egypt's welfare. But there must have been solid grounds for NASA's braggadocio and increasing threats which disregarded all fears of reprisal. And who can say what worldwide ramifications have been avoided or been delayed by Israel's initiative in meeting threats with violence and Egypt's abject cowardice symbolized by the flags of surrender which appeared like some pestilent rash. Only the stench remained in towns and villages, deserted by people with neither the convictions nor the courage to back up their screaming lip service to their arrogant dictator. Here was the silence which arose from the noise and tumult. Striking northwest, fast-moving columns made important gains on the railway leading from Egypt to the Gaza Strip. This thrust to the shores of the Mediterranean cut off a valuable retreat route from Gaza. With Gaza isolated, more places were occupied, deserted save for a handful of inhabitants, bewildered and frightened by the events of the past few days. Left behind in the feverish rush by civilians and army alike to the safety of the canal zone, they gave themselves up with some signs of relief. Among military prisoners were Sudanese, dupes in NASA's fraudulent plans of expansion. Throughout the campaign, 5,000 Egyptians were taken prisoner and some 3,000 killed in battle. There was not much left of NASA's two well-equipped divisions, an over-boosted force of 20,000 men. Israel had broken the lines by which she was to have been garrotted. Closed, full pressure was brought to bear on the Gaza Strip itself. This has always been a thorn in the nation's side. And as the trap closed in, the Israel Defense Forces were in high spirits. The years of apprehension were over, and sweet indeed it was to tear down the portraits of Colonel Nasser, issued in vast numbers to fan the flames of Arab nationalism and hatred of Israel and the West. In Gaza itself, the Israeli flag was run up, a particular moment of triumph and jubilation. The Egyptian Governor General of Gaza came to discuss surrender terms with Asaf Sinkhoni. A year ago in Cairo, this man was a member of a spy tribunal which sentenced innocent Jews to death. Now humiliated, he tasted the bitter dregs of abject defeat. The surrender terms were discussed and set down on a hilltop overlooking an Israeli settlement which has suffered greatly from its proximity to Gaza. Committed to paper, the surrender was signed, though few people are still naive enough to put much store by Egyptian promises, undertakings, or agreements. The final triumph was the capture of the islands of Tiran, ceded to Egypt by Saudi Arabia and used to close the Gulf of Aqaba and Eilat to Israeli shipping. The whole campaign was over in 7 days, during which the southernmost tip of the Sinai Peninsula was reached. For the hard-hitting Israeli forces, it was a triumph of valor, speed, and efficiency. It was the first time that Jews had cast aside their traditional roles of peace and as one nation had gone to war. Their casualties were mercifully light, particularly when measured against the toll taken of the foe who threatened their very existence. But at most, the truce is an uneasy one, and the threat still exists. What further arrogance Israel can expect from her enemies, or what support and help from her friends, time alone will tell. Provoked beyond endurance, Israeli soldiers and civilians fought selflessly for Israel's survival. Her commander, Moshe Dayan, could not have had more loyal support. But the victory parade merely marks the end of hostilities in which Israel has been compelled to sacrifice far more than she has gained. She needs help to solve her final territorial problems, to restore her economy, disrupted by her people's fight for their rights. Without help, a brave, industrious nation cannot hope to survive and ultimately prosper.
All right. Anytime you can use the word braggadocio, it's a good night. Thank you. So that gives you a little bit of a flavor, too, of how the Jewish world was looking at things. You know, when they said the innocent Jews in Cairo, they weren't innocent, right? They were spies, and so on. But nonetheless, in military terms, this was a resounding victory. And the Israelis really didn't need the British and the French. They raced across the desert. What the British and French did was cemented that hold up on the north, just in case there was any thought of a second wave of attack.
But of course, that really what happened is the British and the French initiated, the British initiated the whole thing and was using Israel just as a surrogate. But then it took on a life of its own.
But what I mean by that is the Israelis attacked first.
Yeah, but the Brits were using them as a surrogate to get things started.
Yes, but yes. Everybody was using everybody. No, right. Let's put it that way. The Israelis certainly had a vested interest in this. Remember, they all got together in Sèvres in France, and they talked about their mutual interests. It's unlikely that Israel would have attacked without the approval of the British and French, but it seized the opportunity. All right. Now we come to Moshe Dayan. Very, very complicated figure. Moshe Dayan was a patriot, a soldier, a womanizer, a thief, a liar, and a strategist. He was a lot of things to a lot of people.
Sounds like a great guy.
He's a great guy. He was born in 1915.
What?
This is a picture of him when he was chief of staff in the 50s. He was born on Kibbutz Negania Aleph, which was first kibbutz. He was the second child on the first kibbutz. So his family had some deep roots going through there. At age 23, he joined the British police. Remember, there were tens of thousands of Jews in the British police force, where they got great training in terms of military training. Who knows where these things are at later. He worked with Ord Wingate and night squads. Anybody remember Ord Wingate? Who was he?
Who was sympathetic.
Right. In the Great Arab Revolt, 36 to 39, he was known as the friendly commander. He basically went to the Haganah guys and said, I know you guys are out there doing this, even though the Brits don't know it. Let me show you how to do it right. We're going to lay ambushes, traps. We're going to do a lot of things to get at these Arabs, because I'm very sympathetic to you guys. And as Marshall likes to remind us, he was crazy.
It helps. He used to run around naked.
Kenar, that's right. Yeah, he wouldn't be allowed to teach in a private school today, I'll tell you that much. Joined the Palmach when it was formed in 41. His job was to prepare for the invasion of Syria and Lebanon on behalf of the British. Remember, a lot of the Jews, the Haganah, they were working with the British at this time. This is when he lost his eye. June 7th, 1941. They're across the border. They were stationed at Kibbutz Chanita. They take over a police station held by the Vichy French. It's a very successful raid. There's a lot of hit-and-run raids. He's looking to see if there's any other troop movements across the way on the other side of the valley. A bullet comes, ricochets, hits his lens. Glass fragments go into his left thigh. Because of the muscles that are damaged, he can't have a... I mean, goes into his eye. He can't use a glass eye. He had pain for the rest of his life. He has a fascinating autobiography. It's like this thick. It's called, My Life Story. And it's really interesting if you ever have the time. All these folks wrote biographies. Golda Meir wrote like a small one. She was the only one who wasn't writing all the time. One of the ways that he came to national fame was in a eulogy for a guy named Roy Rutenberg. He was a young man, a security officer. He was killed in 1956 in Kibbutz Nachal Oz. And he was the chief of staff. He delivered the eulogy. And this really began, it's right here on the edge of Gaza, right there. This really becomes the moving portrait of the generation. Because my voice is going, can I get somebody else to read that? Or at least a paragraph at a time, switch off.
Early yesterday morning, Roy was murdered. The quiet of the spring morning dazzled him, and he did not see those waiting in ambush for him at the edge of the furrow. Let us not cast the blame on the murderers today. Why should we declare their burning hatred for us? For 8 years, they have been sitting in the refugee camps in Gaza, and before their eyes, we have been transforming the lands and the villages where they and their fathers dwelt into our estate.
Okay, so hang on a second. Remember, we had some quotes from Ben-Gurion last week that said almost the same exact thing. Of course they hate us. I understand why they hate us. But basically what they're saying is it's us or them. Yep.
It is not among the Arabs in Gaza, but in our own midst, that we must seek Roy's blood. How did we shut our eyes and refuse to look squarely on our face and see in all its brutality the destiny of our generation? Have we forgotten that this group of young people dwelling at Nahal Oz is bearing the heavy gates of Gaza on its shoulders? Beyond the furrow of the border, a sea of hatred and desire for revenge is swelling, awaiting the day when serenity will dull our path, for the day when we will heed the ambassadors of malevolent hypocrisy who call upon us to lay down our arms. Roy's blood is crying out to us, and only us, from his torn body. Although we have sworn 1,000-fold that our blood shall not flow in vain, yesterday again we were tempted. We listened, we believed.
Just hang on for a second. Roy's blood is crying out to us, and only to us, from his torn body. We are all alone. Nobody else is listening to our pain. Finish it up.
We will make our reckoning with ourselves today. We are a generation that settles the land, and without the steel helmet and the cannon's maw, we will not be able to plant a tree and build a home. Let us not be deterred from seeing the loathing that is inflaming and filling the lives of the hundreds of thousands of Arabs who live around us. Let us not avert our eyes, lest our arms weaken. This is the fate of our generation. This is our life's choice, to be prepared and armed, strong and determined, lest the sword be stricken from our fist and our lives cut down. The young Roy who left Tel Aviv to build his home at the gates of Gaza, to be a wall for us, was blinded by the light in his heart, and he did not see the flash of the sword. The yearning for peace deafened his ears, and he did not hear the voice of murder waiting in ambush. The gates of Gaza weighed too heavily on his shoulders and overcame him.
This became something that was reprinted over and over, first in newspapers. People saw this as the call of the generation. And the call was, we have to defend ourselves. Nobody else will. We know we want vengeance. We're going to hold it together. Don't forget, we might leave to go settle the land, which everybody says that we're supposed to do, but don't let the sword drop either.
Who controlled Gaza?
The Egyptians. The Egyptians controlled Gaza until 67.
Do you think he wrote this himself?
That's a great question. I don't know. We know he was a very literate person. I can't answer that. I know prime ministers like Rabin had Eitan Haber write most of his speeches. But, you know, like presidents today, they put their own marks in it and they change it. But it's very good. Rabin goes and has this amazing speech, which we'll look at too, right after the Six-Day War. You know, things that all define the generation. All right. So Moshe Dayan is a war hero, because it's his army that wins the 56 war. As all military people do, he retires. Israel didn't have what's called a cooling off period back then. Now, when you leave the Army, you have to wait 3 years before you go into politics. There's been some moves in recent years to change that to 1 year. For journalists, by the way, it's 6 months. And there are some journalists, like in labor, Shelley Yachimovich, people like this, who have come from the media world. You've got Yair Lapid used to do it and stuff like that. He went right into politics. And it's not news, by the way, that an Israeli general goes into politics. It's not news that someone who served in the Israeli army goes into politics, because basically everybody serves in the Israeli army, for the most part. So I want to ask you very briefly, is it a good idea to have a cooling off period for people who are coming from the military? Because on the one hand, you don't want these people with their military-ness running a country, but on the other hand, these are the people who really know what's going on. So what do you guys think?
They can be consultants.
Hmm?
They can be consultants.
And they are. There are military advisors. Sharon was a military advisor to Rabin in 74 after the, or 70, 75. Yeah?
But you don't want them to start campaigning while they're in the military either.
Great point. You don't want them campaigning while they're in the military. And there are rules against that.
You don't want them to necessarily, take on a battle or avoid a battle, based on forming a political career.
Okay. Anyone else?
If the transition from the military to the political is too close, then they may take that attitude when they go. That I'm a general and I can make the decision.
I'm the boss.
Right. Rather than it's a civilian who should be running the military.
Yeah.
It creates the risk of a coup or the equivalent of a coup.
And there's talk of a coup, by the way. The only time there's really talk of a coup is the 67 war, when the nation was waiting. And guess who was involved with that? Ariel Sharon.
I was just thinking, it's if you have a war hero, it's kind of a disadvantage if they come right out of being a hero and into politics. It's a little bit unfair to the other candidates.
Yeah. Because I think I agree with that, and I think there's good arguments on the other side, too. So he went right into politics, and he went right into the Labor Party, because he was a Ben-Gurion guy. So that was in 1959. He joins Mapai, which we talked about. With Shimon Peres, he's a favorite of Ben-Gurion's. So Ben-Gurion loved Dayan, Peres, and Sharon. In fact, in 64, remember, Ben-Gurion says, "I don't want to be prime minister anymore," in 63. So the next year, he forms his own party, which is called Rafi, which is, again, another, kind of the United Workers list. This keeps guys like Dayan and Peres out of the ministries until Levi Eshkol, in early May 67, calls for a national unity government, in mid-May. He becomes defense minister. He's extremely popular. It's a huge myth that he's the hero of the Six-Day War, as many people would envision him as, because of that famous picture of him, Uzi Narkis, and Yitzhak Rabin walking into the old city. About a week before the war, he becomes defense minister. He didn't build that army. If anyone did, Rabin did. Right? If anyone did, Rabin did. But he kind of engineered that photo, too, by the way. He made sure that he was going to be in it. He's extremely popular wherever he goes, until the disaster of the 73 war, when literally people are throwing things at him and chanting derisive things at him in the street, because they say, "We weren't prepared because of you. You said no to a full military call-up a couple days earlier." And we'll get to it when we get in the 73 war. By the way, I think we mentioned it a little bit last year. 73 war, the intelligence information said that the Egyptians and the Syrians are going to attack, and I think it was 5 p.m. So in the morning, Goldemeyer says, "Mobilize 100,000 people," something like that. Egyptians attacked at 2 p.m. Right? People were coming home from shul.
They didn't want to appear sensitive to the U.S. having a preemptive strike.
Yes. But tell that to the average Israeli in the street. And there was, and the chief of staff at that time, he's from Yugoslavia. he was pressing David Elazar. He was pressing for a preemptive attack. He would go down to basically being kicked out of the army and die a few years later, a broken man.
He wasn't the PM. I think it had more to do with the mindset of the Israelis that we're talking about the 67 war.
73
war. The Israelis, there was a mindset in Israel that we were indestructible.
Absolutely.
That the Egyptians wouldn't dare, even though the troops were moving over towards the canal.
Right.
They wouldn't dare. You saw what happened last.
But not for everybody, right? Because Elazar says, "Let's have a preemptive attack."
And the prime minister, who was Golda, could have said, "No, we're going to have a call up. Mm-hmm. Thank you for your advice, but I'm not going to take it. Let's have a call up." And she deferred to the military people, who said, "It ain't going
to
happen."
To summon the military people. Right. That's what I said. So he wanted the call up. And he wanted the preemptive attack, with the Air Force. 1977, he shocks the political world, and he joins Menachem Begin's government as foreign minister. He's going to become important in the Egyptian-Israeli negotiations. He has left the Labor Party, right? He's not even in Knesset anymore. It's a misnomer, by the way, that you have to be a member of Knesset to be a minister in the Israeli government. I'm waiting for the day when a bold enough prime minister picks all experts in the fields. Right now, Netanyahu has done that a few times. He said Yaakov Ne'eman be the finance minister. Yaakov Ne'eman is an expert in finance, not a member of Knesset. Good move. Very few prime ministers do that because it's political patronage. 1981, even though he's already diagnosed with cancer, he forms his own party called Telem, and he wins 2 seats. He dies in October 81, around the same time that Sadat is assassinated. Let's see. I think that's it. My God. So anyway, tonight we have talked about the austerity, the difficulties, the 56 war, France, nuclear weapons, Israel creating an Israeli, and the great challenges that are therein. Next week, we're going to start talking about kind of the policies of the government and how it operated, and some interesting decisions that it made that have ramifications for today. Are there any questions before we wrap up? Awesome. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.